Today we bring you one of our most requested shows. It includes the famed battle in Berkeley between our own Paula Poundstone and food writer Michael Pollan.
From NPR and WBEZ in Chicago, this is Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the NPR News Quiz. I'm Carl Castle, and here's your host at Cal Performances in Zellerbach Hall in Berkeley, California, Peter Sagal.
Thank you, everybody. Thank you, Carl. We are happy to be here in Northern California, where, yes, that's where we are, where 40 or so years ago, everybody was stoned all the time. And that's why they dreamed of a world in which there was only peace and love and happiness and hemp clothing. Then, about 20 years ago, things changed. People here started dreaming about a world in which people used the same little electronic box to order pizza, make friends, and listen to Portuguese fado music on the elliptical machine. And we thought about that and we realized it's the same people. They never went straight, they just got venture capital. So on today's show, we are going to talk about technology, high, low, and really low. It's a special innovation-themed Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. You can still play the number, 1-888-WAIT-WAIT. That's 1-888-924-8924. It's time to welcome our first listener contestant. Hi, you're on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
Hi, this is Michelle. I'm from Phoenix, Arizona.
Hey, Michelle, how are you?
I'm great. How are you?
Oh, we're good. What do you do there in Phoenix?
I am a mom, and I'm a political consultant.
A mom slash political consultant.
Correct, yes.
Does your experience dealing with young children help you deal with candidates?
Oh, you would not believe what I have learned from my kids.
Really?
The diapering skills alone.
I know. Just cleaning up after.
So helpful.
What kind of mom are you? Hockey or soccer?
Oh, well, both my kids are still in diapers, so I'm really just more of a...
You can still shoot them across the floor with a stick.
I'll keep that in mind.
Michelle, let me introduce you to our panel this week. First, say hello to author, humorist, and the man responsible for everything you'll find at Baudette.com, Mr. Tom Baudette.
Hello, Michelle.
Hi, Tom.
Next, it's the comedian whose new CD, I Heart Jokes, is out on iTunes, Amazon, and her website, PaulaPoundstone.com. Paula Poundstone.
Hi, Paula.
Hey, how are you?
And finally, it's television personality Mo Rocca right there.
Hi, Mo.
Hi, Michelle.
Michelle, welcome to the show. Now, you're going to play Who's Carl this time, but this week, instead of the week's news, all of your quotations will be about brilliant innovations. If you can correctly identify or explain two of these great leaps forward, you will win our prize, Carl Castle's voice on your home answering machine. Ready to go?
I'm ready.
All right. Here is your first quote.
He used to comb the thin strands of hair forward, and of all the honors voted him by the Senate and people, none pleased him so much as the privilege of wearing a laurel wreath. He constantly took advantage of it.
Now that, as I'm sure you know, was the Roman historian Suetonius.
Oh, right, yeah.
He was describing a man some consider to be the father of the comb-over. Mm. Who?
Would that be Julius Caesar?
It was Julius Caesar. What a guy.
Yeah.
Conquered Gaul, overthrew the Roman Republic, gave us a totally kick-ass salad, and now we can credit him with inventing the comb-over, at least that's according to Gersh Kunstmann, author of Hair, Mankind's Historic Quest to End Baldness. He says the Romans in particular were terrified of losing their hair. They tried everything from hippo fat to, quote, salves containing the urine of young foals.
Boy, that doesn't work.
I can tell you. Let me... And the smell. Oh, that was a bad period. Anyway, in fact, Caesar was obsessed with his hair, or lack thereof, right up until the moment of his death when he looked up at his assassin and said, "Et tu pay?"
So,
I apologize.
So when
I deserve that. That's fine. That's okay.
Can you imagine how the lives of bald men throughout the millennia would have changed had Caesar just been bald. Left his hair
alone.
I mean, he was Caesar. He could have done whatever he wanted.
I find it kind of amazing to think of Caesar, who we think is truly one of the great men of history, as being so vain and insecure. I mean, all of a sudden I'm picturing him standing there like, does this toga draped this way make me look fat?
Makes you wonder how it might have influenced like architecture. I mean, if he had Rome built so that people couldn't really look down on the top of his head.
Yeah.
It is. They don't have tall buildings.
Right. No, they did. Yeah. Tall buildings didn't come really until the toupee made the scene. When you think about it, there could be a connection there.
Speaking of great leaders, Michelle, here is a quote from an 1862 speech by Abraham Lincoln.
I believe there is no precedent for my appearing before you on this occasion. But it is also true there is no precedent for your being here yourselves.
Good line, right? Well, right after that apparent big laugh line, in the written copy of the speech, Lincoln used something to indicate he was joking. The first known use in history of what?
Can I have a hint?
Yeah, well, you had to turn, if you really want to get it, you have to turn the paper sideways.
Parentheses?
Parentheses used in a special way with another punctuation. With a
semicolon. Oh, a smiley face.
Right, an emoticon.
Oh my God.
Lincoln, little known fact, Lincoln invented the emoticon.
Wow.
In a transcript of President Lincoln's remarks on that occasion after that surefire laugh line, applause and laughter is noted, followed by a semicolon, then closed parentheses, right? And at least one historian of documents says that then, as today, that symbol was meant to indicate a sideways winking smiley face, an emoticon. We knew that Lincoln was eloquent. It is a surprise to find out he could also be cloyingly annoying.
I'm imagining IMing with Lincoln now.
Were
there any indications of that in the Gettysburg Address?
Well, it does explain something. People have been puzzling about this. In the second inaugural, in the manuscript, right after the famous line, "But let us judge not, that we not be judged," there is the notation in Lincoln's hand, LOL. So,
let's see, it's with malice towards none, yeah. LOL, ROTFLM.
Exactly.
I'd like to see his little IMs to General Meade, you know? WTF.
Yes, exactly. WTF. That's great.
Michelle, for your last innovation, please listen to this advertisement from 1935, read for you by Carl.
Guaranteed. 100% free from splinters.
What product was finally offered squeezably soft and splinter-free?
A hint? please?
Mr. Whipple got splinters in his fingers.
Oh, my God. Wait. Oh, my God.
Oh, a dish sponge? No, wait, Mr. Toilet paper?
Toilet paper, yes, of course, toilet paper.
Oh, what else?
It took till 1935.
Amazingly.
Jeez, what my grandparents went through.
So, yeah, exactly. The next time some television commenter starts telling you that things are just as bad now as the Great Depression, don't you believe it. We're much better off. In 1935, it was the Northern Company that gave mankind another great leap forward, splinter-free bathroom tissue. Took its place along the first sharkless bathtub. The first pants which bent at the knee. And this was important. Fruit of the Loom's historic decision to stop making its underwear from actual fruit. Now, of course, we've moved beyond toilet paper. We do it now with an iPhone app.
The iWipe.
Carl, how did Michelle do on our quiz?
Michelle was perfect, Peter. She wins our prize.
Well done, wow. Michelle. Congratulations. Thank you so much for playing.
Thank you for having me.
Bye-bye. Right now, panel, some questions for you. All of your questions right now are going to be about the brave new high-tech culture, the culture of the high-tech world. Paula, 5 of 2007's top 10 best-selling novels in Japan were originally written on what?
Post-its.
No.
Ooh. Haikus.
That'd be great.
They were written in little short bursts, though.
They were written in little short bursts.
People did it often while riding the trains.
Twitter?
No. It's a great way to use up all those extra minutes.
Minutes. I have no idea. Graffiti.
No. And Mode
on a cell phone.
Yes, on cell phones. Cell phone novels. Biggest thing in Japan. For example, a young woman who calls herself Rin typed out her novel about young tragic love on her cell phone during her commute to and from work. It had a lot of dialogue, not much boring description, fewer vowels than your traditional novel. Printed in book form, it became a huge bestseller. This makes us wonder what the next big evolution in literature after this will be. And we thought it might be novels as Twitter messages, Twitter tweets.
Precisely. I believe I predicted.
You did. It's 140. Has to be 140 characters or less. So here are some examples of novels as Twitter tweets. For example, here's The Grapes of Wrath.
Times are hard. Sister breastfeeding homeless guy. I'm so out of here.
Here's one that I got from an actual Twitter user named Brendan Fox. It's Pride and Prejudice.
I hate that guy. Well, actually, he's kind of hot.
And here, Lolita.
Message removed for violating terms of service.
Thank you, everybody. Right now, it's time for the Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me Bluff the Listener game. Call 1-888-WAIT-WAIT to play our game on the air. Hi, you're on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
Hi, Peter. This is Sasha from Seattle.
Hey, Sasha. How are things in Seattle?
They are sunny, thank
God. Oh, thank goodness. Finally. So what do you do there in Seattle?
I'm a microbiologist.
Well, how totally cool.
Yes.
I was once told that if we actually knew how many microbes are around us at any given time, we'd all scream and freak out. And
probably.
So, really? We just don't want to know.
No, basically. You don't.
How do you manage it, since you know?
I drink a lot.
I understand. Sasha, it's nice to have you with us. You're going to play the game in which you must try to tell truth from fiction. Carl, what is Sasha's topic?
I think of my new device as the fixodent for dear old Mother Earth.
They keep telling us the next big thing is going to be green technology. And our panelists are going to give you three examples of the cutting edge in environmental innovation. Sadly, only one of these new inventions is real. Pick that real one, you'll win Carl's voice on your home answering device, whatever it may be. Ready to play?
Yep.
First, let's hear from Tom Baudet.
California environmental research firm Elliott Martin and Zeller have uncovered that the energy Americans waste to write inside-out underwear could light a small city. The solution, reversible underpants. The team's data showed that 93% of briefs, boxers, and panties end up reversed in the laundry. Turning one garment right side out saps 1/10 of a calorie of expended effort. This calorie is replaced with food, which has to be produced, transported, and prepared. 1/10 calorie doesn't sound like much, but when multiplied by the 600 million times per laundry week Americans alone flip their shorts, it compares to over 300 megawatts of electrical power. The idea behind the reversible underpants, according to Dr. Zeller, is if people did not feel the need to fuss with their Fruit of the Looms, this vast energy savings would be realized. This energy cannot be captured, he explains. It is just never used. We live in a closed system, so think of it this way if it helps. Every time you put your child's Spider-Man briefs spidey side out, a light goes out in Africa.
Saving energy by wearing your underwear no matter how it comes out of the laundry. Your next story of an innovation promising to make the world a better place comes from Mo Rocca.
Houston entrepreneur Paul Johnson is tackling the twin crises of energy and obesity with EcoFit, an eco-friendly gym. The hallmark? Treadmills powered by people. While one person jogs off the pounds, two others get a lighter workout on a seesaw, pumping clean energy to the treadmill. At a slow pace, it all works beautifully. But as the treadmill moves faster, it requires more pounds of seesaw pressure. Many more pounds. For instance, for the treadmill to move at a brisk 15 miles per hour, it requires 520 pounds of seesaw weight, roughly two Poseidon Adventure-sized Shelley Winters. To keep up the pace, management has to fuel the seesaw sitters with a constant supply of yodels and soda. As the runners have gotten thinner, the seesaw sitters have gotten fatter, and tension between the two camps has increased. Faster, yell the sitters to the runners. Fatter, shout back the runners. I wanted to do something good, said Johnson, and now my gym is being torn apart by ergonomic apartheid.
a treadmill powered by a seesaw and vice versa. Your last story of an invention that would make Al Gore smile, assuming he could, comes from Paula Poundstone.
Somebody did it. I think we've all thought of it, but finally someone has done it. Energy giant BKW FBM is just waiting on the funds to start work on a solar-powered submarine. The company says the sub would draw power from a floating solar array of five generators with 430 square feet of panels. The sub could dive to depths approaching 1,000 feet and shoot through the water at almost 6 miles per hour. It's unclear what the use for a solar submarine would be. An enemy might be able to find a submarine that drags five generators each with 430 square feet of panels. They're kind of like lobster traps with weapons. Not so useful. Still, somebody finally did it.
All right. Here are your choices. One of these is the real innovation. Is it from Tom Baudet reversible underwear? Saves energy because you don't have to reverse them. From Mo Rocca, a seesaw powering a treadmill, causing some strife between the treadmillers and the seesawers. Or from Paula Poundstone, the world's first and, we would bet, last solar-powered submarine.
Wow.
Yeah.
I'm going to go with the solar-powered submarine.
Your choice, then. The solar-powered submarine. The audience approves. Well, to bring you the correct answer, we spoke to the journalist who brought our attention to this story.
Picture a cartoonish-looking submarine attached by a giant extension cord to something that looks like one of the hats that they wore in Devo with some flattened disco balls attached to it.
That was Keith Barry, a reporter for Autotopia from Wired.com. Congratulations, you got it right, Sasha. Well done.
Wow.
You've earned a point for Paula, just for telling you the correct story, and you've won our prize. Carl Castle will record the greeting on your home answering device. Well done.
Thank you.
And I want to say something. When this gentleman wrote up the story for Wired.com, he finished up his description of the planned solar-powered submarine by saying, and I'm paraphrasing, but this is what he said, the only thing this is good for would be to be one of those fake stories they have on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. So we are happy to oblige him. Thank you so much for playing with us, Sasha.
Bye.
And now the game where we like to talk to experts in one field about something else entirely. Michael Pollan is the most well-known authority on food and food economics working today in journalism. In his books, The Omnivore's Dilemma and In Defense of Food, he sums up his advice as eat food, not too much, mostly plants, which, of course, is absolutely un-American. Michael Pollan, welcome to Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
Thank you.
Great to have you here.
Thank you, Peter.
I just want to say, as we start, I'm a huge fan of your books. One of the reasons I like your work is because I love conspiracy theories. It's a hobby of mine. And you are like this conspiracy theorist, except there really is a conspiracy. Apparently, I mean, to summarize your work, the reason we're all fat and sick is Richard Nixon's fault.
Well, that's a gloss on my work.
I understand. Yeah. It's my take.
Well, yeah, there was this interesting moment of hyperinflation, hyperfood inflation, back in the 70s when he was running against McGovern, who was a farm state senator, and he was really afraid of losing the farm vote. So he made this grain deal with Russia, and that drove up farm prices, secured the farm vote, but afterward it led to this bout of hyperinflation. And women were in the street protesting the price of butter. There was horse meat showing up in the butcher shops, and people were really upset. So he hired Earl Butz, the sage of Purdue, an agricultural economist, a brilliant man, and gave him the job of drive down food prices, do whatever you can to make food as cheap as possible in America. And he did. He figured out a new way to subsidize agriculture. He persuaded farmers to get big, only grow corn and soybeans. With the result that we increased the amount of corn we grow from 4 billion to 14 billion bushels, and soda got really cheap, and meat got really cheap, and we got really fat.
It's almost Dickensian, Earl Butz.
Yeah. So, and then in addition, all the in your latest book, In Defense of Food, you take on like the nutritionists, the people who've been telling us like every day, well, you need to eat more of this, and the next day they say, no, you don't. You need to eat more of that.
We're very confused about food, I think, which, you know, which is weird. I mean, what other species needs experts to tell them how to eat?
Yeah.
Well,
but it's been a good career for me.
I can't tell you how many times I've had to tell my dog to get his head out of the garbage can. So
all right. So what should we be eating?
Food.
You know, how thick is your book?
It's very hard, actually, for us now to know what food is, because there are all these edible food-like substances now that compete with food in the supermarket. So a lot of the book is helping people distinguish between the edible food-like substances and,
right.
and the real
like,
food.
Like, for example, one of my rules is food does not come with a prize.
That's good. I'm going to use that one.
Wait. Cracker Jacks do, though. I don't understand. What? Yeah.
Okay, but let me ask you something. One of the things that has made my life worth living is ringdings. And I feel that it is food. Are you going to tell me that's not food?
There's a few simple tests to figure out if a ringding is food or not. How many ingredients does a ringding have?
A devil's food cake, one.
Yeah. Now, see, right there.
Yeah. A creamy filling, yeah. two.
And
a rich chocolate outer coating. What's the matter with you?
I think I would look at the package next time. That creamy is not cream.
It C-R-E-M-E-Y. Creamy. What the hell's the matter with you?
But. There are, you know, there are special occasion foods.
And what do you mean special occasion? I said it's what makes my life worth living. Are you suggesting I save it for one day a year?
I wouldn't want to deprive you of your ring.
You know what? You may know a lot about food, but you don't know the first thing about living, buddy.
Hold on. I actually wanted to ask you that. You've become this hero. You've become this hero of the whole foods, local foods, real foods movement. Is that a burden? If you ever want to eat a cheeseburger, do you have to go hide somewhere?
Well, I did. Shortly after I got to Berkeley, I was in Berkeley Bowl, and there are a lot of...
Berkeley Bowl, just for people who aren't blessed enough to live here.
It's a local supermarket which has wonderful fresh produce, grass-fed beef. It's your idea of hell, I think. And my son, when he was young, really liked Fruity Pebbles.
I bet he did.
I love
that.
And that was his Saturday, breakfast. And I was actually reaching for a box of Fruity Pebbles. And somebody tapped on my shoulder, and it was this tall, bearded graduate student. And he said, and I'm like this, he said, I'm watching Michael Pollan shop for groceries. And I didn't go in that store again for many, many months. Another rule is don't eat any food that won't eventually rot. I had a Twinkie for 2 years. I owned a Twinkie that I...
Oh, you did not.
Really?
I did. I have it. I didn't bring it with me. I have it in my shelf in my office, and I would give it a squeeze every couple of weeks to see how it was doing.
Like Mr. Whipple.
And
that's not good for them.
And
you bruised your Twinkie.
Two years later, it was as soft and spongy as the day I bought it.
If you can't,
but if you unwrap it, you didn't unwrap it.
I didn't unwrap it.
All right. My problem, I try to teach my kids to eat healthy food, but you get a cantaloupe and you don't know when it's going to come of age. You have no idea that period between when it's like hard as a rock to when it's smushy inside. It's about 10 minutes.
Right.
And ringdings. Sometimes you got to wake the kids in the middle of the night because the cantaloupe's ready. Your kid wanted Fruity Pebbles just so he could sleep.
Well, Michael Pollan, we have invited you here to play a game that this time we're calling...
Honest to goodness, if I had one of these in my home, I would never leave the bathroom.
So, you're an expert on food, what we put into our bodies. And we were casting around for something you might not know anything about. And we eventually decided on the other end of the process. And nobody handles that better than the Japanese. We are going to ask you now three multiple choice questions about the latest high-tech electronic Japanese super toilets. Get two such questions right, you will win our prize for one of our listeners. Carl, who is author Michael Pollan playing for?
He is playing for Linda DeSantis of Berkeley, California.
All right. Here's your first question. Leading Japanese high-tech toilet manufacturer Toto Corporation offered free repairs to one model after some of that model were found to do what? A, burst into flames. B, circulate water clockwise in the shameful Southern Hemisphere fashion. Or C, lower the motorized toilet seat back down too quickly, shocking and in some cases trapping male users who were just taking a little bit too much time.
I'm going to go with C.
You're going to go with C. They're just boom, ow, that. Well, you're right in that many of the toilets have motorized lids that go up and down by themselves, but in this case, the problem was they were bursting into flames. Yeah.
Doesn't that depend on what you eat?
No. These toilets are highly mechanized and motorized with lots of electronic components, and in this particular case, the bidet attachment was catching fire.
Yeah, but corn syrup can douse that.
Yeah, that's why it's important to have. All right, we have two more questions for you. Here's your second one. Right?
Are they all about toilets?
They are, in fact, all about Japanese super toilets.
Okay.
Many Japanese public restrooms, already equipped with futuristic toilets, have upgraded them further with a device called the Sound Princess. What does the Sound Princess do? A, it plays a coaxing, gentle female voice to help men get their business done just by encouraging them. B, it simulates the sound of water flushing to cover other bathroom noises. Or see, it rates the strength of your urination by its sound as a measure of prostate health.
Oh, gosh. I'm going to say B.
You're going to go for B. You're right. It covers the sound. Japanese people, especially women, are reputed to be very embarrassed by bathroom noises, so these devices, the Sound Princesses, cover it up with whatever noise they choose. All right, this is exciting. One for two. You have one more question to go. Get this, you win. They're not done, Japanese toilet engineers. Just recently, a model went on the market with what? New feature, A, a massage attachment that will reach up and rub your shoulders as you use the device. B, a personalized MP3 player that will recognize you by your weight and automatically play your favorite music. Or C, a remote control to save you the trouble of having to turn slightly to use the control pad.
I'm going to go with C.
You know the remote control?
Yeah.
You're right!
Hey!
Hey! Hey! Little remote control, so you can, you know, operate its features. By the way, the remote control on the new model has a big button that's labeled in English, stop. And the reason is because Westerners in Japan have had a problem. They don't know how to deal with these toilets, and there's been incidents of people being trapped on them or spraying water all over the bathroom, so they want to make it easier for Uigaijin.
A panic button on
exactly.
Your toilet remote.
You know, you've given me an idea for a sequel.
Really?
Yeah.
There you go.
This whole conversation.
That's great. I'm so glad to help. Carl, how did Michael Pollan do in our quiz?
Well, Michael had two correct answers, Peter, and that's good enough to win for Linda DeSantis.
Well done. Michael Pollan is the author of numerous best-selling books, including The Omnivore's Dilemma. His latest is In Defense of Food. Michael Pollan, thank you so much for joining us. What a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Have a banana, Anna. Travis Salami, Tommy. Give it the gravy, Davy. Everybody eats when they come to my house. Try a tomato plate too. Here's Cacciatore, Dore.
Thank you, Carl. Thank you, everybody. Coming up on this technology-themed show, Carl puts on his fedora, gets his bullwhip, and digs into the Listener Limerick Challenge. If you'd like to play, give us a call at 1-888-WAIT-WAIT. That's 1-888-924-8924. Right now, panel, some questions for you, and all of your questions right now are about strange but brilliant inventions. Mo, sometimes a patent is richly deserved when an inventor breaks new ground and improves the lives of millions. Other times, well, listen to this excerpt from a patent application in 1999.
An apparatus for use as a toy by an animal, for example, a dog, to either fetch, carry, or chew that resembles a branch in appearance.
What was this so-called inventor trying to patent in 1999?
It's for a dog.
It's for a dog.
And it resembles a branch, mm-hmm. but it's actually used for fetching.
So it's a sort of thing that looks like a small branch that a dog might fetch.
Like a bone, a fake bone. Is the dog fetching this thing, or is the dog using this to fetch?
That Mo, or is that your iPhone app that sounds like Mo? Because it's very good.
I only wish that the audience at home could see Peter's face.
No, I don't understand.
It looks like a branch, and you might throw it for a dog.
It's
made of wood.
Oh, it's a branch.
Yes.
It's a stick.
It's a stick.
Yes, sir. Okay.
You filed.
Because it's so silly that you wouldn't have guessed
You might think that in your youth you used a similar device when you played with your dog, but you couldn't have because Ross Eugene Long III didn't invent the stick as a dog toy until 1999. You might be surprised that nobody thought of that sooner, but you may be more surprised to learn that the patent was granted by the U.S. Patent Office in 2002, at which time Long, on a roll, also applied for a trademark on the phrase, "Go get it, boy." His next big idea, a granular mineral substance used to cover the ground, he calls it dirt.
Oh, so it actually wasn't a stick.
Well, yeah. It's a stick that, yeah. But what's interesting is that it's a stick, it's like a toy that looks like a stick, but it's made of wood.
Right.
So it's a wooden-shaped thing that looks like a stick.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Wow, geez, that's really trippy.
It is.
So often you look at a thing and it says patent pending, and yet... Yeah. The stick patent
was granted. Yes.
Yeah. They're not even waiting on that baby. They got right to that.
Yeah, next time you throw the stick, you owe the guy $20. Tom, Louis XI, King of France, was also an innovative musician, as shown by his greatest invention. What?
The Moog. No, the... Louis XI. You don't hear a lot about the XI.
No, you don't. And it's a shame.
The 11th Louis.
Because this guy,
I mean, it goes back a ways. But yeah. I don't know when the 11th was. Probably before the 16th, right?
I would say. I'm oriented. Let me check. He was exactly five Louis before Louis the 16th.
So.
You skip Louis the 13th.
So an instrument.
It was an instrument. It was an instrument. That used a really novel technology.
A wind-powered organ. Louis the 11th. A kazoo?
No, it wasn't a kazoo.
I thought it was.
Oh, thanks, Mo. Set me up for the kazoo.
I wanted it to be the answer.
No, it's not the kazoo. Can I have is there any more of a hint you can give me without just giving me the answer, please?
I'll try to replicate its effect. Oink, 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 oink.
A pig? Oink,
a pig organ.
A pig organ.
A pig organ. Pigs squeal, of course. But different pigs, as you, I'm sure you all know, squeal in different notes. So the king had arranged an array of carefully selected swine. They were placed in stalls. And a mechanism connected to a keyboard, so the pressing of a key caused the correct pig to be poked. A poke in a pig. And thus sound its note. He used it to perform Mozart's lesser-known masterpiece, Eine kleine Schweinmusik.
Yeah.
Coming up, it's Lightning Fell in the Blank, but first it's the game where you have to listen for the rhyme. If you'd like to play on air, call or leave a message at 1-888-WAIT-WAIT. That's 1-888-924-8924. Or you can send an email to waitwait@npr.org. You can also go to our website at waitwait.npr.org, where you can find out about attending our weekly live shows in Chicago and find information about our upcoming show in San Francisco at the Opera House on July 14th. Tickets on sale this Monday. Hi, you're on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
Hi.
Hi, who's this?
This is Paul from Kailua, Hawaii.
Kailua, where's Kailua and which island?
There's three of them, but I live in the one that's on Oahu.
Oahu, wow. And are you from there, or were you lucky enough to end up in Hawaii?
I was a New Yorker.
You were a New Yorker?
And moved out here with my girlfriend and everything I owned in January of 81.
Really, and how have you been enjoying it?
I love it.
Wow.
Let me guess, about 82 degrees, western winds, 15 miles per hour today.
Windward and mocha showers.
Yeah.
He's miserable.
Yeah.
Hey, somebody's got to do it.
Your sadness comes down the line, sir. Paul, welcome to the show. Carl Castle is going to read you three limericks with the last word or phrase missing from each. If you can fill in that last word or phrase correctly, and two of the limericks will be a winner. Now, we've been talking about high tech this hour, but now we're going to leave that aside and go into the past. All of your limericks are about the science of archaeology. Archaeology. So here's your first archaeological limerick.
Baghdad's jars rattle round, rather clattery. No, they're not an old, inhumane cattery. Through them, Signor Evolt gets a posthumous jolt. When they're filled, they're a lightly charged...
battery?
Battery, yes. The Baghdad battery, one of the great mysteries of archaeology. It's a 2,000-year-old jar with a copper-wrapped iron rod inside. Theoretically, if you put fluid in it, it could hold a charge. Did the ancients invent the battery? Some scientists think it's all nonsense. Others think it was brought to ancient Iraq by a time traveler. Others believe that the jar points toward the meaning of an artifact found nearby, also unexplained, the mummified remains of an enormous rabbit beating a bass drum. All right. Very good. Here is your next limerick.
Down in pyramid lanes, balls would roll. Old Egyptians had great wrist control. Did they know about pins or how to count wins? We just know that they love to...
bowl?
Right, bowl. Apparently, after the ancient Egyptians invented beer, they came up with an appropriate activity to pursue while drinking it. Bowling! According to an Italian archaeologist, quote, we first discovered a room with a very well-built limestone floor, then we noticed a lane and two stone balls, unquote. The game played by the Egyptians is not exactly the same as the game played today, but the discovery does explain why one pharaoh's consort is depicted in a bas-relief sculpture wearing a nylon shirt with the name Cleo embroidered in the front. All right, you have one more limerick. Let's hear it.
The Stonehenge slabs amplify waves. Ancient beats would make folks misbehave. The pulsating dance would whip up a trance, and the parties just might be called...
rave?
Yes, Stonehenge. Long been one of the mysteries of the world. Was it a religious site, an ancient observatory? Well, according to Rupert Till of Huddersfield University in England, it was dance party central. Because the huge stone slabs reflect sound perfectly, Till believes that ancient Britons gathered at Stonehenge to listen to repetitive trance-like music. Dance all night, waving their glow gourds about. It also explains why so many prehistoric accounts refer to ancient druids doing the walk of shame across the moors the next morning. Scientists also believe they've traced the origins of the popular rave party drug ecstasy back to Stonehenge. Back then, of course, it was called tolerable misery. Carl, how did Paul do in our quiz?
Paul got them all right, Peter. Three correct answers, so he wins our prize.
Well done.
All right. Honey, go get the bucket list.
Absolutely. You're done. Knock it off. You got nothing left to do. Your life is now officially perfect. Congratulations and well done.
Well, thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Aloha.
Stonehenge, where the demons dwell, where the banshees live and they do live well. Stonehenge.
Now it's time to move on to our final game, Lightning Fill in the Blank. Each of our players now has 60 seconds in which to answer as many fill in the blank questions as he or she can. Each correct answer now worth 2 points. Carl, can you give us the scores?
Mo Rocca has the lead, Peter. He has 3 points. Tom Baudet and Paula Poundstone are tied for second. Each has 2.
Okay, we have flipped a coin to decide who goes first. Tom, you're up first. All of your questions are about science fiction movies.
I'll go second.
Fill in the blank. Too late. The first ever science fiction movie is credited to Georges Méliès back in 1902. It's called A Voyage to Blank.
A Voyage to Poughkeepsie.
Voyage to the Moon. George Lucas became one of the richest people in Hollywood by giving up his salary but retaining the merchandising rights to his blockbuster movie Blank.
Star Wars.
Right. Despite its completely incomprehensible ending, Stanley Kubrick's movie Blank became a big hit.
2001, Space Odyssey.
The shocked reaction of the other actors in the famous chess buster scene from the movie Blank is due to the fact they weren't warned what would happen.
Oh, the alien.
Right. All of Khan's henchmen in the movie Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, were played by Blank.
Klingons.
No, Chippendale Dancers.
Well,
the dystopian classic about overpopulation, Soylent Green, ends with a revelation that Soylent Green is blank.
People.
Right. The alien in E.T. was created to look like a combination of Carl Sandburg, Albert Einstein, and a blank.
Lapradoodle.
Close, a pug dog.
Oh!
After actor Bela Lugosi died before he could finish filming Plan 9 from Outer Space, his role was taken over by blank.
Bela Lugosi taken over by, boy, this was not my category. It was taken over by Arnold Schwarzenegger.
No, by the director's wife's chiropractor.
Wow!
To cover up the fact that his wife's chiropractor...
It's who you know in Hollywood.
Yeah. He didn't know anybody. To cover up the fact that his wife's chiropractor looked nothing like Bela Lugosi, director Ed Wood had him walk around with his cape pulled up over the lower half of his face all the time. Plan 9 is, of course, considered to be the worst movie ever made. Carl, how did Tom do in our quiz?
Tom had 4 correct answers for 8 more points. He now has 10 points and the lead.
All right. Paula, you are up. That's good. Paula, you're up next. All of your questions, Paula, will be about the exploration of space.
Oh, great.
There you go. In 2008, Pluto was reclassified and lost its formal designation as a blank.
A planet.
Right. To test the effects of space travel on living things, in 1957, Russia sent Laika the blank into
space dog.
Yes, it's space dog. NASA's $125 million Mars climate orbiter was destroyed because a subcontractor forgot to use the blank system.
Metric.
Right. Appropriately enough, the first song to be beamed directly into space was Blank by the Beatles.
Blank by the Beatles. I want to hold your hand from really far away.
No. Across the universe. Among recent improvements to the International Space Station is a device which converts blank into fresh drinking water.
Sweat.
Yes, also the astronaut's urine, that too. In 2007, a NASA panel found that at least 2 astronauts had been cleared to fly while blank.
Drunk.
Right. Astronaut Lisa Marie Nowak made headlines in 2007 when, to confront her romantic rival, she drove 900 miles wearing a blank.
Diaper.
Right. NASA's Johnson Space Center was endangered in 2008 when billions of blanks invaded Houston.
Billions of cicadas.
No, electronics-eating ants. Known as the crazy raspberry ant, these exotic bugs eat fire ants, which is good, and electronics, which is bad.
This is the wrong series of questions. That should have been in the sci-fi one.
No, it's true, though. They were seen at the Johnson Space Center. NASA asked men that spotted them to take one small step and crush them. Carl, how did Paula do in our quiz?
Paula had 6 correct answers for 12 more points. She now has 14 points and the lead.
Well done. All righty, then.
It's about space exploration.
You bet.
That's really my area.
God, there are no categories left that I know.
How many, before we start Mo's round, how many does he need to win?
6 correct answers.
All right, here we go.
It's going to be organic chemistry or something.
Close, Mo. All of your questions are about medical science. Here we go. This is for the game. Fill in the blank.
I'm a Christian scientist.
Fill in the blank. A sheep named Dolly was the first mammal to be successfully blanked.
Cloned.
Right. Alexander Fleming discovered blank when he noticed mold-destroying bacteria in his lab.
Penicillin.
Right. Not just good for the soul. A recent study found blank was also good for high blood pressure.
Not just good for the soul?
Yes.
Love.
No, chicken soup. The first so-called blockbuster drug was the mild tranquilizer blank, also known as Mother's Little Helper.
A mild tranquilizer, also known... I'm such a clean teen, I don't know. A tranquilizer that was also known as Mother's Little Helper. Oh, a Valium.
Right, Valium. People with a condition known as pica have an insatiable urge to blank.
People known as pica have an insatiable urge to dance.
No, to eat dirt. Couch potatoes rejoiced lazily in 2008 when a blank pill was discovered.
Couch potatoes, when a weight loss pill.
No, an exercise pill.
An exercise pill.
Okay. Frat boys will be living longer thanks to a Rice University team that's developing a blank that fights cancer.
Oh, a beer bong.
That would be great. No, just beer, Mo. Just beer.
Okay.
During the 1900s, the St. James Society, a philanthropic organization, tried to help morphine addicts kick the habit by blanking.
Oh, By giving them heroin?
Yes, by sending them free samples of heroin in the mail.
Wow.
The heroin, produced by Bayer, you know them, was intended to help them get off morphine, which had been touted as a way to get off opium. Which had been touted as a way to kick alcoholism.
So then the Cat in the Hat wasn't an original idea.
No, apparently not. Carl, did Mo do well enough to win?
Mo needed 6 correct answers. Peter, he had just 5.
Oh.
So with 14 points, Paula Poundstone is this week's champion. Yeah,
whoa!
Space exploration. That's really my area.
You're going to be the first panelist in space.
Oh, I hope so.
In just a minute, we'll ask our panelists to predict the next world-changing, earth-shaking scientific innovation. But first, let me tell you that support for NPR comes from NPR stations. And eSurance, where customer support is available 24/7, 365. eSurance car insurance, people when you want them, technology when you don't. Lumber Liquidators, whose flooring includes pre-finished and stained solid hardwoods, bamboo, cork, and laminates. Information at lumberliquidators.com. And Chase, offering the Marriott Rewards Premier credit card. Details at marriottpremier.com/radio. Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me is a production of NPR and Chicago Public Radio in association with Urgent Haircut Productions, Doug Berman, executive producer. Philip Goedeke writes our limericks. Our web guru is Beth Novi. Thanks also to Robin Pomerantz, Hollis Ashby, and Amy Ferrara and the Cal Performances staff at Zellerbach Hall in Berkeley, California. BJ Liederman composed our theme. Our program is produced by Ian Chillaw, Eva Walchover, and Emily Ekdom, with technical direction from Robert Newhouse, Lorna White, and Shireen Strasberg. The senior producer of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me is Mike Danforth. Now, panel, what is going to be the next new thing that turns the world upside down? Tom Baudet.
A food source that can be maintained with ordinary dirt, water, and energy from the sun. Hey, wait a minute.
Paula Poundstone.
A power-generating couch.
And Mo Rocca.
A pocket-sized iron you can use on your pants without taking them off so that when you go out for an evening with freshly pressed pants and sit down for dinner and in the process wrinkle your pants, you can simply go to the bathroom and iron yourself.
Well, if any of those great ideas come to pass, panel, we'll be asking you about it on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
Thank you, Carl Gassel. Thanks also to Tom Baudet, Paula Poundstone, and Mo Rocca. Thanks to all of you for listening. I am Peter Sagal. We will see you next week. This is NPR, National Public Radio.